chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, and no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are. Rest make heaven.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with Charlotte Littlefield. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We want to welcome a really fine guest tonight, Dr. James Vaughn. He specialized in a study of the British East India Company. Welcome to our program, Dr. Vaughn.
Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Butler. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, the British East India Company was a very unusual company and a chartered entity. Tell us a little bit about generally the British East India Company.
Sure. So it is a very unusual entity, as you said. Basically, European trade to Asia was very difficult. Europeans began in the 16th and early 17th centuries rounding the southern tip of Africa in order to be able to have direct access to the spices and coffee and silks of the Far East and to be able to cut out the middlemen traders in Italy and the Levant and the Middle East. And as a result, a lot of the European powers seeking to round the Cape of Africa set up joint stock companies. What they were was they were wealthy merchants, well-off merchants that lived in places like London and Lisbon and Amsterdam and who pooled their capital in order to provide the ships and the resources necessary for these far-flung ventures to set up trade in the ports and cities of Asia. And in essence, what the deal was between the various European states and the merchants who launched the East India companies was in return for the merchants taking on the risk and pooling the resources to be able to explore and trade with Asia, in turn for them doing that, the crowns of Europe tended to give those merchants monopolies, charters that gave them privileges and monopolies, so they had the sole trading rights between their particular European country and around the Cape of Good Hope to Asia. And over time, the great European East India companies, above all the French East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, and most importantly, the British East India Company, really established vast mercantile factories and port cities and sea lanes throughout the Asian world so that by the 18th century, these companies run really, coastal cities, coastal enclaves, massive trading routes, and with that, they start to take on a great deal of political and administrative power over the European and Asian populations that live within their various settlements and port cities. And so by the middle of the 18th century, these great European trading companies like the British East India Company are not merely commercial corporations. They also run quite substantial administrative and political structures in the Asian world. Now, not to go on forever, but in about the middle of the 18th century, the British East India Company and the French East India Company begin to become involved in rivalries between South Asian powers on the Indian subcontinent, with the French East India Company backing one kind of rival to the throne and the British East India Company backing another rival. And in between roughly the 1750s and the 1770s, this process of backing rivals eventually leads the British East India Company to have direct territorial imperial control over one of the largest and by far the richest province of the Indian subcontinent, of the Mughal Empire, Bengal. So you've essentially got a joint stock company rooted in the London stock market, rooted in corporate headquarters in London, not merely trading to Asia, but by the second half of the 18th century, governing 20 million plus Bengalis over which it is the direct imperial power.
Boy, Dr. Vaughn, that is amazing. the power that they had, and also did they not wage wars with their own private armies or what?
Yes, that's right. What happened was European trade to Asia was a very risky adventure. Not only did you have to set up settlements and trading posts with Asian powers who knew very little about Europe and with which there was very little diplomatic connection with Europe, but also there was a great deal of hostility between European rival powers. So, for instance, the Portuguese, who were really the first European power, they attempt to monopolize it. And the Dutch and Portuguese fight wars against one another, and then eventually the British and the Dutch fight, and the French and the British. And what ends up happening is all of these European commercial companies are given increasingly military privileges from their crown. So, for example, the French crown and the English crown, they don't really have the ability to project power in the Asian world. So what they do is, as part of the charters that they give to these mercantile trading companies, they give them quasi-sovereign powers. They say, you know, I, the King of England, I, the King of France, I have the right of violence, I have the right of life and death within my realm. But you merchants who are going beyond to trade in Asia, where I have no, my writ doesn't run and my power doesn't extend, I'm going to delegate to you, through this monopoly charter, quasi-sovereign powers where you have the right to set up juries, you have the right to trials, you have the right to administer settlements, and you have, as you pointed out, Mr. Butler, the right to launch wars, the right of life and death. And often they do, in fact, get involved in wars with one another. Although that's always tricky, meaning that the crowns at home still have a great deal of say in how the companies, the degree to which the companies can wage war abroad.
Right. My brief reading of it over the years out at the university in the Perry Castaneda Library, there's a whole section there, and it's not an easy thing to talk about, is it not, Doctor? The British East India Company. It's a vast, it has a historical, vast historical, you know what I mean, over a decades, if not centuries, several centuries, and it's not that easy to even talk about, is it not?
That's exactly right, sir. I mean, basically, the British East India Company is founded in the final year of the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. And it exists right up until the mid to late 19th century. And it's an incredibly complex affair because what you essentially have is it's a commercial corporation operating in an increasingly expansive corporate headquarters in London whose primary purpose is to have commercial profitability by trading with Asia, so that it can pay out very high dividends to shareholders back home in Europe. But over time, because of the nature of trading in Asia, it acquires incredibly powerful military and political abilities. And after the middle of the 18th century, roughly 150 years after the English East India Company is founded, it becomes a sovereign state on the Indian subcontinent. It becomes a great territorial empire. And now, if you can imagine the kind of, if you'll forgive the term, absurdity of it all, the artisans and peasants and indigenous people of Bengal are now ruled by a company whose main purpose is commercial profitability and shareholder value that's sitting in London. And it's that way for roughly 100 years from 1757 until 1857, when finally, because of what's often known as the Sepoy Mutiny or the Great Rebellion, it's a massive rebellion of traditional authorities in India, against the East India Company's rule, that destabilizes the East India Company, and finally the British Parliament decides that it's necessary to intervene and to take direct rule. And so we often have that brings across the switch from what historians call the Company Raj to the Crown Raj, meaning that instead of the East India Company governing India, the Crown comes to govern it directly in 1857, 1858, and finally Queen Victoria is crowned Empress of India, I believe, in 1876. But what's really interesting is they don't just have Bengal, the East India Company. They get Bengal in 1757 to 1765, roughly. But between 1757 and 1857, essentially the East India Company takes over control of the entire South Asian landmass. Either they have direct control of the people of South Asia, or they essentially have as their quislings and their subordinates indigenous Nawabs and Nizams and princes that essentially, even though they're technically formally sovereign, they're nevertheless under the influence and control of the East India Company.
Right. Was one of the most important products or trade items opium, and was that imported into China? Is that where the big market was for opium?
Yes, that's right. So to make a long story very, very short, initially when the East India Company takes control of Bengal, the first major part it controls of India, its primary purpose is to purchase South Asian textiles and then sell them at a great markup back in European markets. And because it's a monopoly company, it faces very little competition, so it's able to make a great deal of profits. But once it controls Bengal, it has an immense tax power. It has incredible powers of taxation within Bengal, and it begins collecting land taxes in Bengal. And instead of sending out gold and silver with which to purchase South Asian textiles, it uses the land taxes it raises through its empire in Bengal to pay for the South Asian textiles. Now, over a long time, this system doesn't work so well. And so what happens is they begin to set up many multilateral trades in Asia. And so what they decide to do is grow opium in India so they can in turn sell it in China and pick up various porcelains and teas that are highly profitable back in Europe. So that's really essential. So that's the way that the opium trade really becomes set up, is the need for the East India Company to be able to remit its revenues back home to Britain. It finds the need, therefore, to produce something in India like opium that it can in turn sell within East Asia, within China, in order to purchase porcelain teas that are highly, highly profitable back home in Europe.
Is it correct to say that they only demanded to be paid in gold for the opium? Is that correct?
Is it correct to say that the East India Company?
Yeah, would only accept gold for the opium to be paid only in gold
from
the Chinese?
Well, it's slightly complicated, which is to say there's both the East India Company and then there are private British merchants selling
okay.
there. But it's initially, at least, it's not so much gold as it is Chinese porcelains and tea that are really crucial and important for sale back in Europe, because those are worth a great deal of money. In fact, long story short, you're familiar with the Boston Tea Party. So
yes,
the Boston
uh-huh.
Tea Party, they're not dumping British tea into Boston Harbor. They're dumping East India Company tea into Boston Harbor, which is...
Man, boy, that's a good insight,
yeah,
isn't it?
And that's a very important thing, because what's basically happening is the East India Company is becoming massively indebted. And so it goes to the British government around 1772-73 and wants to be bailed out, right? And so what the British government does is passes essentially a series of acts, one of which is called the Tea Act, where they decide to lower the customs. That they allow the East India Company to trade its tea directly to North America and lower the customs on that tea. So it essentially will be highly competitive in its sale of tea to North America. And a lot of small-scale American merchants don't like this, because the East India Company essentially is this vast monopoly corporation. And furthermore, a lot of colonial radicals don't like the fact that the East India Company has an imperial despotism in South Asia. Meaning, if you think about what colonial American radicals stood for in the 1760s and 1770s, above all, they stood for no taxation without representation. And when they looked over to Bengal, looked over to India, what the British government and the East India Company were doing was constructing an empire that had absolutely no indigenous councils, no indigenous assemblies. There were no South Asians represented in any of the halls of power of the East India Company. And so it was the purest expression of a kind of despotic empire that could tax without having to have any representation or any check. So in a weird way, you get this in a lot of radical American literature of the 60s and 70s. They point out that in India, the British are beginning to build an empire that is not based on the spread of British law, the spread of British representation, but rather based on despotism, on being able to have a military and a standing army that allows you to tax without having to listen to the locals at all, right?
Yes, yes. What the monies that were generated from this great trade of the, by the British East India Company, much of that was brought back to Britain, and did it form the basis for expansion of the city of London and its financial dealings?
Well, yeah, it's a kind of complex answer. It's sort of both yes and no, which is to say that yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is the East India Company in its But going way back to its commercial phase, before it had any kind of empire, going back to the early 17th century when it was founded, the East India Company was a key player in the so-called City of London, the sort of English version of Wall Street, the commercial and financial hub of London. And its merchants and shareholders were extremely important. And by the late 17th century or the early 18th century, roughly around 1700, East India Company stock was extremely valuable. It was like a blue chip stock. It was something that you knew was secure. You would get a solid return on over many years. Furthermore, the East India Company loaned a great deal of money to the British state. Basically, the British state had an immense public debt, and the East India Company is one of the key loaners of money. And the reason why that's important is because the company required a monopoly charter, meaning it wanted that monopoly charter so it didn't have to face competition from other British enterprises and merchants. And so in order to make sure it could secure that monopoly charter, it constantly offered loans and grants to the government.
Boy, I tell you what, that became did it become a monster at times where it was out of control? Even the government had to rein it in, or what?
Yes, definitely. The East India Company was an incredibly powerful corporation, and also it was so deeply linked. The problem is the East India Company was so deeply linked into the London stock market and into London finances and commerce, and also into the public debt and into the British state, that even though it became necessary to rein it in, you always had to be extremely delicate with it, because if the East India Company collapsed, or if it didn't pay out successful shareholder dividends, or it collapsed as a corporation, that would send shockwaves throughout the London stock markets, the London financial community, and the British public debt and the British state. So British ministers always had a very complex relationship with the East India Company, where they desired to manage it, but they also knew that they didn't want to create too much instability because it could rock the boat far beyond the confines of the corporate boardrooms of the East India Company.
Right. It almost sounds like too big to fail, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. That's amazing, because to point that out, because when they start to get an empire in India, many British commentators, newspaper people, members of parliament, writers of pamphlets point out how absurd it is that a commercial company has become a despotic empire in India. That this is just completely absurd, that what are merchants whose sole goals are commercial profitability and shareholder value, why are they running an empire in India? And a lot of people want to intervene and to change this connection and to transform the nature of the British Empire in India. But one of the strongest arguments against any reform or any change or any revolution in the East India Company's affairs is that it's so deeply entangled in the public debt, in the state, in London stock markets, with the Bank of England, which is the kind of public banking system of England. Because of that, it is exactly, people don't have the term too big to fail, but they do have incredible fear about the kind of shockwaves messing with it might send.
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting, Doctor. Did the vast fortunes that were made by some officials, top officials, did that form the basis for the new politics
that's
in Britain?
That's a very interesting question. So there's sort of two kind of wealth generated, right? Let me give you an example of the kind of system that went on. There were incredibly
sure.
wealthy merchants and financiers in London who kind of merely managed, and they invested in the East India Company, and they simply drew shares from it, or they were corporate managers. But they sat in London. They were elite merchants and financiers. They had holdings all over the place. And essentially, they drew a great deal of wealth from the East India Company. Now, there was another layer of East India Company officials and servants. They were the people who actually went out to Asia. They were in Canton in China. They were in Calcutta in Bengal in India. They were in Madras and Bombay in India. And they were often extremely entrepreneurial, extremely hardworking, and they were the ones who really, they were not just investors and shareholders, they were also entrepreneurs and merchants on the ground who discovered trade routes, who worked with native Indian and Asian merchants in collaboration to set up trade routes and shipping lanes, and they developed a lot of wealth from this relationship. So there are really kind of two kinds of wealth generated. There was the kind of rent wealth from the merchants and financiers who sat in London and controlled the monopoly corporation. And then there was wealth generated by the people who actually went out. They tended to be middling sort or lower class people who went out to make their fortune because it was a great risk. I mean, you had a 50% chance of dying. It was extremely difficult conditions and weather and disease. But they went out to try and ply Asian trade, to be entrepreneurs, and often they would make great wealth, right? And so you had kind of two different kinds of wealth generated.
Right. The date given as the initial founding of the British East India Company, 1600, correct?
That's actually correct. I said it was the last year of the reign of Queen Elizabeth, which is wrong. That's 1603. It is, in fact, 1600 turning into 1601. Macaulay has something. Thomas Babington Macaulay, the famous English 19th century historian, has a beautiful line that it's one of the last kind of royal acts of the 16th century.
Right. Did the aristocrats of England first turn their nose up at the British East India Company, but later embrace it because of the vast fortunes that were being made?
Yeah, that's a good question. Initially, the East India Company is really well-off merchants, like not your kind of middle-class or more entrepreneurial merchants, but really well-off merchants connected to the halls of power in London, particularly the court and the ministries. And they're the ones who initially ply the trade. And the landed classes aren't that involved in it. But by the time the East India Company becomes a very successful affair, you get landed class people who invest in it. Because the gentry and the aristocracy, the kind of the nobility of England, they're not interested in actually being involved too much in day-to-day mercantile commercial activity, but they like to be able to invest and make dividends. Now, what happens is after the British East India Company starts to become an empire, meaning after the second half of the 18th century, what begins to happen is there's a reform movement at home within Britain. There's a kind of a radical and moderate reformist movement that wants to eliminate corruption. Because up until that point, in the second half of the 18th century, gentlemen, aristocrats, and the landed classes had often used the patronage and the resources of the state to kind of give themselves more wealth and to reproduce themselves. And there's a strong movement for reform at home to eliminate what's known as old corruption, which is the way that landed elites use patronage in the state to benefit themselves. And what begins to happen is a lot of landed elites look towards this new empire that the East India Company is building in India, and it becomes a key source of patronage for themselves. They'll send off their sons, right? They'll send off their connections to India, because if you think about it, what's going on in India is you have a vast bureaucracy with a vast standing army devoted constantly to war, constantly to conquering and expanding and to taking over the entire Indian subcontinent. And that vast imperial state requires many officers, many governors. And so as the landed classes are losing patronage and corrupt resources at home, they begin to build a spot for themselves in India by manning this huge empire that's being built.
Yeah, one of the complaints that I hear today about India is that it still has a vast bureaucracy that's very difficult to deal with. Was that a result of the British East India Company?
That's a good question. Let me do it by way of comparison to Britain. In Britain, really because of the English revolutions of the 17th century and a lot of reforms and transformations in the 18th and 19th century, the state is really subject to civil society, meaning it's a kind of a representative state. It's a weak state. It's able to do the things it needs to do, but it doesn't have a lot of strength to arbitrarily act in society. But what happens in India is the East India Company builds up a very despotic empire, where basically a kind of a tax-collecting bureaucracy and a huge standing army are the state. And they're not for you've got to, if you think about it this way, that state that gets put down in between 1757 and 1857, over 100 years, it's a huge tax-collecting bureaucracy and standing army that has no parliamentary checks, no counselor checks, no democratic checks, no representative checks, no members of Indian society itself involved in the formation of policy, the determination of statecraft. And that state basically rules completely over India. And the way it looks at India is basically just a field of resources to extract as much as it needs to reproduce itself and to pursue its military and geopolitical aims. And it's really not subject to Indian society at all. And what happens is there begins to be a lot of pressure for liberal reforms and radical reforms leading right up through the Indian nationalist movement. But still, the state that is bequeathed to independent India is still a very strong bureaucratic state. And there's no question that that has to do with part of the legacy of the British imperial past, that there had never been the kind of thoroughgoing revolutions that we see in Britain, that we see in France, that we see in the United States, that really, you know, made the state subject to civil society and citizens.
Right. As far as any slave trade, was the British East India Company involved in the American slave trade?
No, not in any serious way. It was, the reason being is the slave trade was focused on West Africa, and initially it was conducted by, there were different phases, but an important phase in the second half of the 17th century was conducted by another monopoly company, not the East India Company, but rather the Royal African Company, the RAC. And then the Royal African Company lost its monopoly after the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And then the trade in West African slaves is conducted largely by independent British merchants. The East India Company, Mr. Butler, mostly has to focus all of its trade beyond, from basically in between roughly the Cape of Good Hope at the southern tip of Africa through to roughly the Philippines. That's its kind of purview. And so it's not allowed to operate in the West African state.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this, too. Textiles was important. Was cotton important coming out of the colonies in any way, progressing and trading it and,
sorry,
and shipping it into
cotton,
India,
sir?
Or not? The cotton itself coming out of the American, colonies or the South,
so,
you know.
Ever since the days of the Roman Empire, people living in Europe have actually most highly valued the textiles and silks of South Asia, because in certain areas of Asia, above all
in northeastern India,
because of the way the Ganges is and how fertile Bengal is, multiple dyes and colors, the most beautiful cotton and silk piece goods were capable of being produced at very low cost. And so really, since the days of the Roman Empire, the textiles and the silk and cotton piece goods of South Asia are really highly valued. And so really, up until roughly the 1820s, Europeans, and above all the British, are importing textiles from South Asia to Europe, to Britain. And it's only with the Industrial Revolution, it's only with places like Birmingham and Manchester experiencing full-blown industrialization, that the British are able to make those high-quality textiles and cottons and silks at a relatively low cost and begin to essentially not only not import South Asian textiles, but begin to actually export their own textiles at a lower cost to South Asian textiles. And by the 1840s, when cheap and good-quality British textiles begin to flood Asian markets, essentially manufacturing begins to completely be destroyed in India. And what we see is something very interesting. Sections of India like Bengal had a great deal of pre-industrial manufacturing in these fine silks and cottons. But when industrialization happens in Britain and Britain is able to export extremely low-cost, high-quality textiles to India, these manufacturers tend to go out of business. And as a result, they essentially, India becomes an even more rural and agrarian society because essentially there's a flight of resources and activity back to the land.
Right. The trade, of the British East India Company, so to speak, generated certain vast income flows, of course. Was there a tremendous consolidation then of capital? And it was formed, that capital formation then was formed in London, in the city. But did it not come back to Britain and then was a basis of a tremendous capital formation?
That's an interesting question.
Period for Britain.
There is really endless historical and scholarly debate over to what degree the empire in India contributed to what you're calling capital formation in Britain, right? Or if we could put it even more broadly, economic development growth. Now, there's a huge debate. I'll be honest with you. There are many reasonable people who disagree on this. My opinion, which is a wide opinion but by no means the only opinion, is that the Indian Empire benefited certain interests, but it did not benefit economic growth in Britain overall, meaning the industrialization that took place in Britain, the kind of things that happened in places like Birmingham and Manchester, the move in the 19th century to self-sustaining growth that delivered higher rates of labor productivity and GDP than we've ever seen, that to me I don't think is connected at all to the empire in India. Rather, the kind of wealth generated to India and the dividends it paid out, the profits it paid out, the revenues it remitted, that benefited particular groups that were linked to the Indian Empire. Above all, the kind of commercial and financial and landed elites that controlled the East India Company and were able to fill positions in the British Imperial Service in India.
Right. So you're saying during the 16, 1700s, the commercial trade did not benefit the average Briton citizen that much, or the standard of living did not.
That's correct.
Was
it
not
mostly benefited the merchants
immediately
involved. I don't want to discount it because because it had other kind of effects in Britain, when these really wonderful textiles arrived from South Asia, that encouraged a lot of British manufacturers and European manufacturers, French, Dutch manufacturers, to experiment because really, Europeans are mostly producing woolen textiles and maybe a bit of a mixed textile like a new drapery, but these incredibly high quality dyed, multicolored Indian textiles really encourage a whole revolution in taste and consumption. So it has other effects. But generally my view is the Indian Empire helped certain interests connected to it, but overall it can't explain what we often call the British economic miracle, the fact that Britain was the first society that went into self-sustaining economic growth.
Right. So the Industrial Revolution is what really got Britain motivated or into the into an economic growth period. Kicked it off. Is that right?
Personally, sir, is that that Britain had transformed to, by the eve of industrialization, to a commercial society in which everyone no longer produced for their own consumption. They didn't work to clothe themselves or to feed themselves or to shelter themselves. Rather, they worked to get money or a wage, which they could go out and buy the product of other people. And this was an incredibly interdependent economy where people worked to be able to get money to buy the products of other people's work. And this kind of interdependent economy, as brilliantly described by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, this led to the growth of the division of labor and the expansion of the market. And it was really this process and not any money accumulated in the Indian Empire that led eventually to industrialization. It created a competitive, entrepreneurial, commercial society where people were constantly looking for ways to reduce production costs, increase profits, and industrialization is really born in that of that world.
Right. Have there been many people that have concentrated in this area in the last several decades, or are you one of the few people that have concentrated in this
study? The East India Company is one of those great historical conundrums. It's one of those things that will always draw every generation, some scholars, towards it, because it was this incredibly long-lived corporation. It not only was one of the... there's a very famous article by a scholar whose name escapes me at the moment, but the title is the first multinational corporation. I mean, East India Company is operating in Calcutta, it's operating in London, it's operating the whole world over. It's got settlements and factories and employees all over the world. It's got vastly entangled networks. And it's this great global corporation. And then, of all things, it actually, for over the course of 100 years, transforms into a massive empire that unifies all of India by conquering one of those populated regions in the entire world, and it becomes a ruler of it. So the East India Company is not only the first global corporation in many respects, the first corporation of a genuinely global influence and reach, it's also a corporation that rules a vast, vast, highly populated region of the earth as an empire. And so because of that, it will always draw historians and scholars that will always be engaged in this debate over how it came to be as successful as it was and why it transformed in the mid to late 18th century from a purely commercial corporation to not only a commercial corporation but a great territorial empire in India.
Right. What would you say were the good benefits versus the bad benefits of the British East India Company?
The good benefits of the East India Company are the fact that it was the... I'll give you a great example. When it went out to South Asia, Mughal Emperor, which was the key power in South Asia, he largely allowed the European companies and the British East India Company to settle ports in on the coast. Places like Bombay, Calcutta. And in these areas, these relatively unpopulated areas, the British East India Company built settlements and built port cities that really went from being often very tiny forts and very tiny fishing villages to huge commercial port cities where the merchants of the world gather. Armenians, Persians, Malays, Chinese, Bengali, Marathi, a Sephardic Jewish, Portuguese, Dutch, French, all of these citizens of the world, all of these merchants and artisans came into these British East India Company port cities. And Calcutta is an incredibly large city by the middle of the 18th century, and it's something that went overnight from being a small village to a huge city. And the reason why this is so great is this is really... Calcutta is one of the first places where people of very different religious and ethnic and cultural backgrounds came together to exchange resources and to work cooperatively in trade and production to be able to contribute to the world. And it's amazing that this place like Calcutta could go from 50 years to being essentially a village to a great coastal city where merchants of all the world gathered together, and they felt their private property was secure. They felt security from the state. They felt that they could operate freely and come into joint ventures with one another and explore and discover new markets and sell new goods. Now, that's one of the great sides of the East India Company, that it's a kind of bridge of building a world of commercial interaction, entrepreneurship, and people being able to exchange goods and ideas with one another. The downside of the East India Company, couple of things. One, it was a jealous monopoly corporation. It always, always sought... It had a monopoly of the trade between Britain and Asia, and it always sought to keep out all competitors. And as a result, it tended over time to be a less entrepreneurial corporation and more concerned with just being able to ply its traditional conservative trade. It was less exploring. It was less entrepreneurial. What it preferred to do was have a monopoly over the trade and simply be able to set monopoly prices rather than have to compete with other British merchants. And that was a negative aspect of it. And another negative aspect of it was that once it conquered Bengal, the way it viewed India was not as the East India Company did not view India as that this needs to be turned into part of a greater Britain, that what had happened in North America, where Britain had essentially in the American colonies created a Britain West. There were people who, when the East India Company started to get an empire in India, they wanted the British merchants and adventurers in India to create a Britain East, to create parliaments, to create free trade, to settle colonial plantations, to build a kind of European-Asian interaction, polity, society together. But instead, the East India Company sought rather to build an imperial despotism, which monopolized trade, which had a vast standing army that conquered a lot of areas, and which had a bureaucracy that collected taxes and was unaccountable to any representative or democratic institutions. So what happened is they built a very un-British India, and in fact, a very famous Indian liberal, Dadabhai Nauroji, writes a book in the mid to late 19th century called Un-British Rule in India. And he's criticizing the British Empire not for conquering India. He criticizes the East India Company not because it conquered India, but because unlike in North America and unlike in Britain itself, it didn't create a liberal democratic commercial entrepreneurial industrial society, but instead it created a kind of imperial despotism with a vast standing army and an unaccountable tax-collecting bureaucracy.
But it effectively established a geopolitical power base, did it not, and kept the British in a very superior position. Is that true?
No question. That, you know, Mr. Butler, the standing army that gets built in India, right? What's kind of very interesting is, since the 17th century, there's no standing army in Britain. There's no powerful standing army in Britain because Parliament views the standing army as a tool of the Crown that the Crown can use to do away with Parliament and to rule despotically. So in Britain, the standing army is limited. They tried to build the standing army in North America. The American Revolution happens, and as a result, they don't get the standing army they search for in America. But then eventually, they're able to build a vast standing army in India, and they use that standing army to project power in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia. Remember, it's in part the forces of the East India Company that roll into places like Burma, that roll into places like Egypt. So there's this vast standing army made up of a European officer corps and an indigenous sepoy standing army. And what that army does, that army is paid through taxes and revenues raised on Indians themselves in South Asia. But it projects power in defense of British imperial and geopolitical and commercial interests throughout the African and Asian world.
Boy, I tell you, you've really done well in studying this. And it's such, like I was saying earlier at the beginning of the program, it's not an easy subject,
is it? The problem is, since the company is a 250-year-long company, it's hard to even talk about the East India Company because it's so different at different points in time.
Right. So, yeah, you've got this. There are decades, if not centuries, of differing the way it was organized, the way it was run, the way it was dominated by certain interests and so forth. And it's so. And then you had these interactions of these other trading companies. Is that right? And they were finally, what, pushed out by the British East India Company? How did that work out? Because of the arms or the standing army? Or how did the British come out on top?
In the mid to late 18th century, the British East India Company, the French East India Company, enter into South Asian politics. The Mughal Empire is weakening throughout the 18th century. And what's happening is it's beginning to be replaced by successor kingdoms. And these South Asian successor kingdoms aren't one great empire. Rather, they're small kingdoms each competing to become the new great empire. And the French and the British East India Company align with various successor kingdoms against one another to try and back the strongest power. At the end of this process, essentially, the French East India Company really makes an attempt to eliminate the British East India Company. As a result, the British East India Company gets very involved in military affairs in South Asia, eventually totally defeats the French East India Company, and then the policy the British pursue is that other Europeans can trade in Asia, can trade in India, but no one can have a political or a sovereign or a military force. That it's only the British East India Company that's going to be a military and political power, and all other Europeans will trade at the sufferance of the British East India Company.
Right. The university, Yale University, I believe, was established by a governor of the British East India Company. Is that correct? Yale. Yeah, Yale. What was that one of the American connections to the British East India Company or not?
The governor of Madras, and which is now known as Chennai in India, and that's where he really made all of his wealth. And he was, by the way, a controversial governor. And as you can imagine, you know, beyond far away from Britain, far away from British law and British standards and practices, there's always endless quarrels and squabbles between British servants in India over who's doing what legitimately and illegitimately. So Eli Yale made a fortune, and there were those who said it was illegitimate and so forth. And I actually, if memory serves, sir, I don't think Eli Yale actually did go to North America, but you might want to check that. I'm not certain. I think he just left a part of his wealth he used to fund the endowment and the foundation of Yale College.
Yeah, it says here, one reference, it was formerly, Yale was named Collegiate School. Collegiate School was the original name. When Yale endowed or provided a gift to the school, then they changed the name to Yale.
Okay.
But that was in 1718. Okay. Now, I don't know a lot about his life from there, you know what I mean? But it was a gift that he gave to help the school become better funded, I'm sure, like a lot of bequests and so forth and so on.
Yes,
but that's
much
an interesting connection there, I thought. Anyway, what other little tidbits of interest that you might have run across in your studies that would be interesting to our listening audience tonight about the British East India Company? Or is there something that we left out that you'd like to reiterate or expand your thoughts on a little bit?
You know, what's funny is if you go and look at famous British personages or historical figures, there are often connections to the East India Company. So, for instance, John Stuart Mill, the great Victorian liberal, was a writer for the East India Company within Britain. Thomas Babington Macaulay, one of the great 19th century historians, he went out and worked for the East India Company's imperial service. Lots of famous British personages have connections. The only thing I would reiterate at the end here is essentially that the East India Company the questions it really ended up posing, the reason why it's important to study is because although it was a corporation primarily concerned with commercial profitability and ultimately the maximization of shareholder dividend, it really also raises the question of the European contact with the Asian world and what the nature of that contact is, what that contact was and what it might have been if things were done differently. And so the East India Company really is one of these ways in which a unified world was built in many respects, right? An integrated, interdependent world was built. And so I think the study of its history is important because it's important to study how we went from being, you know, roughly autarchic societies to societies profoundly interdependent on one another, how a world market was built. But also, it shouldn't just be studied to know the facts, but also to see the potentials that went unfulfilled or unrealized. So it's always worth looking at the East India Company, not just for what happened, but also what might have happened if something happened, if something was done differently.
Yeah, would you say that the British East India Company established world trade on a real large basis? International trade?
It was a contributor to that. There's no question. It was a contributor to that, which is why, you know, even though its profits and the capital it realizes does not go directly into industrialization and economic development within Britain, it's nevertheless the case that one can't imagine a Britain that industrialized and experienced economic development without all of these massive global trade routes that Britain was part of and that encouraged a lot of people to focus on producing for the market and to trade around the world. And the East India Company certainly had an invaluable role to play in that.
Right. Getting back to this opium dealing, was that about one of the worst things that the British East India Company was involved in
it was
China?
Would you think? A historian whose work I respect a great deal, a historian of South Asia named David Washbrook, calls it the world's first narco military empire. Right? It's almost
What does he call it? Narco military empire.
If you think about the East India Company's empire around the turn of the 19th century, right? It's essentially pushing opium in China in order to be able to realize its profitability and remit revenues back to shareholders and merchants in London, right? So that is absolutely something that it does. And it's definitely, and of course the opium wars take place as a result and so forth. And the question always then becomes, could there have been a kind of European, Asian, or British Indian interaction that didn't necessarily lead to that kind of East India Company relationship with the despotic empire, the opium trade, but rather that led more towards a kind of Britain East being built, which is to say a kind of society in which Indians from the get-go participated in parliaments and councils. There was a free trade policy that, just like in North America, the British Empire had pursued policies that helped the economic development of North America, that they pursued such policies that helped the economic development of South Asia. That's the kind of world we've lost. It never existed. It's a kind of counterfactual. It's interesting to ask, but it's worth thinking about.
When do you think the British Empire reached its pinnacle of power? Would it be during when the British East India Company was the most active and they had the biggest armies, or what? They control the most countries. About what period did Britain reach its pinnacle of power?
Is probably, I would say, roughly from the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815. I mean, so Britain is basically not a player in Europe or the world for much of the 16th and 17th century. Then, starting in the late 17th century, it becomes one of the European great powers. And basically, by the middle of the 18th century, there are only two games in town, Britain and France. And then, with the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815, there's really an unchallenged British global political and economic supremacy, which lasts, I would say, with a few tremors and some hiccups until roughly the First World War. So 1815 to 1914 is the kind of century, if you will, of the kind of Pax Britannica.
Right. In Britain today, they have stepped back somewhat from this European Union. What would be your futuristic or little predictions into the future about where Britain and in relationship to the European Union, where is Britain going in relationship to the European Union?
That's an interesting question. I'm not altogether certain because that's a very interesting question. I think the best speculation could be this. The European Union, before the financial crisis of 2008, a lot of commentators were predicting it's the path of the future, that they're going to be building a United States of Europe, and the British sort of reluctance sort of was viewed skeptically. Now, since the financial crisis, all of that kind of commentary from pre-2008 looks very silly. The European project looks to be in heavy turmoil. And essentially a lot of powers have even, I don't think it will happen, but a lot of powers like in Greece and so forth, there's been talk of leaving or breaking up the union. So my sense is that ultimately the European Union will remain a purely economic project of economic integration, and there will never be a United States of Europe. That is to say, there will remain European nation states largely sovereign over their own policies. They'll never have a one formal foreign or military policy. And essentially, I think that the way that both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, with some differences in Britain, view their role is to kind of be a key Atlantic player where they maintain one foot in this European Union and this process of economic integration, but they also remain a close ally of the United States. And so I think that's the role that they continue, the kind of what Tony Blair sort of maneuvered, I think they consider their role, basically. But basically, I think the idea of a United States of Europe is essentially, in my opinion, dead. I think the EU will go on as a process of economic integration, essentially.
Right. The cultures are still different. The languages are different. But the trade across the internet and instant transfer of the pound into whatever, of course, the pound is still being used in Britain, but from the pound into the euro is instantaneous,
so.
Is it not? See, so trading goods, I'm talking about internet here,
yeah,
primarily, not major trade here. But just buying and selling on the internet is so instantaneous and stuff. Then the business, the European countries can be tied loosely together through electronic clearing of trades with each other.
That's absolutely right. And so it remains to be seen. I think that the British will maintain maintain political independence and to some degree legal independence from the kind of process of European unification, but I think that the British state will, you know, continue economic integration.
The pound, though, doesn't look like they want to integrate that into the euro.
There was
they don't want to do that, do they?
When New Labour came to power, Blair and Gordon Brown, there was some desire to do that. But they always wanted to manage public opinion to an important degree, and there was always talk of a kind of a referendum. And I think that any referendum to do away with the pound would also ultimately go down to defeat, and it also doesn't look like good financial and monetary sense right now to do away with the pound.
Right. I agree with you, Dr. Vaughn. Well, Dr. Vaughn, thank you very much for being with us this evening. This hour has gone by so quickly, you know, and we've been 57 minutes and 32 seconds into it, and it's like it was just seconds ago. But you're really a fine professor. You've got a great knowledge of the British East India Company, and I wish you all the luck in the world
in
your
Mr.
studies.
Butler,
but thank you for being with us this evening.
I appreciate your audience's listening. Good night.